Welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's science, technology, and innovation. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. We got a couple of great events to tell you about this show, including the Honolulu Mini Maker Fair. We're going to hear from Ross Mukai of Oahu Makerspace.
And then we'll be talking about the recent King Tides and part of the citizen science involvement. We'll talk to Matt Gonzer and Shelley Habel, and they're both from the University of Washington. University of Hawaii. What am I talking about?
You're from the University of Washington.
Yeah, sorry.
Now, we do want to start letting you know about the June, this month's HVCA luncheon. Every month we like to feature this event. It's coming up on June 22nd. That's a Thursday at 11:30 at the Plaza Club downtown, 900 4th Street Mall. Now, this month's luncheon is focused on kidpreneurs, or young, very young entrepreneurs, and it's a great panel talking about people who are fostering the next generation of business people. And the panel includes the great Brian Dote from Mid-Pacific Institute. We have Steve Su from Lemonade Alley, Lauren Name, Ian Kitajima from Oceanit, and Josh Repun, who is really passionate about the film Most Likely to Succeed. So if you want to attend that event again on June 22nd with the HVCA, you can go to hvca.org.
Very good. Of course, next up, we want to invite Ross Mukai, who's sitting right here in the studio with us, and he's here to tell us about the upcoming Mini Maker Fair. Welcome to the show, Ross.
Thanks, Bert.
Now, I asked you earlier, what number is this Maker Fair? Did you come to a conclusion?
This is the fourth annual Honolulu Mini Maker Fair.
It's been 4 years.
That's amazing.
We've been doing this for 4 years. It's amazing.
That's great.
Now, the Mini Maker Fair is an event that I love. It happens in cities all around the world, but the specific twist that Hawaii and Honolulu puts on it is pretty fantastic. For those who might have missed your many blessed appearances on the show in the past, what constitutes a maker?
Well, a maker is anyone who's doing something really, you know, creative, unique, something new, bringing something into the world that didn't exist before, whether that's code or it's an art or crafts or, you know, producing creative work.
So you have 3D printers, you have knitters, you have painters and people who work with various materials.
Yeah, there's the robotics guys, the 3D printers. I mean, and even the drone folks are coming by, right?
Yes, there's actually going to be a drone tournament on the baseball field, Iolani School. They're going to have head-to-head the FPV or first-person view drone races. That's always a really neat competition.
So what constitutes FPV, first person view?
So you're watching the race from a camera in the drone, and you're actually flying with either a video headset or a screen in front of you from the perspective of flying in the drone.
Are other people going to be able to see what the pilot sees, or we just have to imagine that it's the speeder bike scene from Return of the Jedi there?
I think sometimes you can look over someone's screen if they're not wearing goggles, but for the most part, I don't think we blow up the video display.
Now, Ross, you have been on the organizing committee, and every year it's almost like what you do, Ryan. I mean, in terms of the Geek Meet, you have to basically call everybody up or contact everybody to be a participant, and there may be, what, 30, 40 tables really representing different makers.
Yeah, all kinds of makers. You know, there's everybody doing different things, and that's really what the great thing about the show is. There's so much diversity from the knitting people to the blacksmithing people, there's some woodworking people, there's electronics people, you know, computer people, everybody. It's really great.
Now, are you, this is a free event, and how's signups doing now?
It's good. In fact,
you don't have to sign up, right? You can just show up. So
you can, but we recommend that people do sign up. Mm-hmm. That way we're able to track how many people are there. Mm-hmm. And we've been tracking attendee growth over the past couple of years that we've been doing it, and the show actually gets bigger and bigger every year.
Sure, what was the number last year?
I think last year we were over 1,000 attendees.
Amazing.
Wow.
Now, I like coming to the event. I bring my kids. You should bring your kids. My favorites include, I love the blacksmithing demonstration. There was a woman who had found a way to use a automated system or some sort of pen to write or draw pictures on eggs. I thought that was really, really cool. Do you have a favorite? I mean, Oahu Makerspace, obviously, is the coolest exhibitor, but second to Oahu Makerspace, who do you look forward to seeing every year?
I always look forward to seeing people that I've never seen before and meeting people that I have not met before. That's really the best thing when, you know, if you're working by yourself and you're not aware that other people are doing the same thing, then you realize that you're part of a larger community and you have people you can share experiences with and you can work with them and everybody can build off of each other. And that's really the best.
You know, one of the fun things that I like to participate in over at the Maker Faire is usually High Capacity has a soldering workshop,
mm-hmm.
and they always have some cool little kit that results in blinking lights. And I'm a real sucker for blinking lights.
Actually, in another attraction that is not often appreciated for people who don't regularly visit the Ulani Sullivan Center is the elevator. I look forward to see what they do. There's the elevator itself is a work of art, a living exhibit, and it's different. I think at least twice a year. So that's something to look forward to as well.
We love the elevator. The students at Ulani decorate the elevator differently every semester or whatever the period is. But we do recommend for the Maker Faire because there's so many people in there on that one day that you take the stairs if you can. Because I think 2 or 3 years so far we've actually like overheated the elevator.
Wow.
Like, no, you know, just take the stairs if you can. You know.
Now, usually the soldering workshop is downstairs in the Ulani sort of maker space that they have. And they have a pretty extensive maker space downstairs.
Ulani has a really nice shop. They have a lot of heavy-duty equipment. They have a lot of, you know, really inclusive stuff. Like they have some electronics. They have some craft stuff. They have laser cutters. And the Maker Faire, we do the soldering workshop down on the first floor in their lab because the space is pretty much already set up for it.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, High Capacity runs the soldering workshop. And HTDC, the High Technology Development, you know, they sponsor part of the event and they provide a lot of the hardware that we use for the soldering.
And workshop. Ross, what is Wahoo Makerspace going to be showing off this year?
I'm probably going to bring out some more like CNC machines. For our booth, I'm trying to work with the Wood Turners Club. Because I do a lot of wood turning, and they do a lot of wood turning. So if I can get some more volunteers from them to do the demonstrations for the wood lathes, I'm going to bring some wood lathes. But whether I run the wood lathes or whether I run the CNC machines, you know, it remains to be seen. Some of our other guys from our shop are also going to be working with 3D printers. We're going to work on some 3D printers that are printing different materials. We'll see how different.
All right.
I'm not sure yet.
You know, again, this is a great event, very family friendly. You should bring your kids and check it out. A lot of things hands on. Just be careful to be sure which ones are hands on.
So, Ross, where can people sign up?
You can sign up to attend, or if you want to participate, we may be able to squeeze people in, even though we're a little over a week out, at honolulu.makerfaire.com.
Fantastic.
Very good. Put it up on our show notes later on tonight. And we want to thank you, Ross, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bert.
And, of course, we'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by Matt Gonzer and Shelley Habel. And we'll talk about the recent King Tide phenomenon. And, of course, don't go away. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
In the morning, I have my juice, my toast, and the BBC. In the evenings, especially Saturdays and Sundays, I like Seth Marcos' show. I love American Roots. If I'm in the mood for classical music, again, I can just push the other button and listen to it. If I'm driving, it seems like whatever's on is good.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. Now joining us are Matt Gonzer and Shelley Habel. Matt is an extension agent, community planning and design over at the University of Hawaii Sea Grant Program.
Shelley, meanwhile, is a PhD candidate at the University of Hawaii at Manoa Department of Geology and Geophysics.
And of course, why are king tides getting so much recent attention? Matt and Shelley, we want to welcome you both to Bite Marks Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, I want to answer that question, and maybe I'll throw it over to Matt, because I know we've had you on the show before talking about king tides. And then a couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks ago, there was like a incredible news coverage of the king tide event. And there was footage all over the place about the tides rising and the waves crashing against the seawalls. And What contributed to that attention?
Sure. So there's really two questions in that, right? So one, you had us on in the past, and one thing to highlight about King Tides is that it's not a new phenomenon. Mm-hmm. These are predictable and these are recurring, and King Tides is really just a colloquial term for the highest high tides of the year.
Mm-hmm.
We did not make up this term. You know, people use this globally, and there are those that are documenting King Tides events around the globe, around the United States as well. So mm-hmm. We're really capitalizing on that momentum and engaging citizens in doing that. But as you alluded to, why was it so
well covered?
Well covered in May. And to be honest, we hadn't even intended to do our photo surveys in May, because we just look for the two highest forecasted periods for our summer high tides, and that's actually next week and July 21 and 22.
Mm-hmm.
But there were all these other things that were contributing to the water levels around the state. Again, I'm not an oceanographer, but in essence, we had multiple things that were stacking up to contribute to what would have just normally have been a kind of high-ish high tide, but not the highest high tide. So we had a high tide around May 25, 26. We had a south swell. We obviously have the continued trend of increasing sea levels throughout time. But the biggest anomaly that contributed to this was this sea level bulge, for lack of a better term. We've had elevated sea level states around the islands of Hawaii for some time now. And what we were seeing is that it actually contributed, at least for the Honolulu Harbor tide gauge, almost 10 inches additional to what was just the predicted.
And was that primarily contributed to by the south shore swell that came in?
No. So those are all distinct factors.
What causes a bulge?
That's above me. But
wow.
In essence, there's some discussion about, you know, El Nino, La Nina. We have different weather patterns, but that also shifts where water is in the entirety that is the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, or typically, we'll get most of that pushing out towards the Western Pacific. But you get some of that sloshing back and forth, and there's significantly more science around that, which I can't really attest to. But as users of these information and the things that can be forecasted, we, as you mentioned, got really good coverage to get people out there and observing and documenting these high water levels.
Now, you know, Matt made reference to the science of it, and maybe that was a cue to get you to say a little bit about what's your involvement with this whole King Tide phenomenon, Shelley?
Well, mine is kind of tricky because I'm looking at groundwater inundation.
Mm-hmm.
So how groundwater is going to be lifted above the terrain as sea level rises. So that's kind of tricky to observe during a King Tide because it's still below the ground. So some of my colleagues look at beach erosion or coastal flooding. And so when they make models regarding the future, these King Tide events help them to make sure their models are working properly to kind of calibrate them.
So can you explain a little bit more about how it's still underwater in terms of what you study? Like, for example, people look at Mapunapuna, where there's reliably an intersection that's underwater anytime there's even a regular high tide, it seems, not just a King Tide. Is that part of your field of study?
Kind of. So I do look at storm drains, too. So that area, it's really wet over there because water is coming up and through the storm drains. It's like, so those storm drains are driven by gravity flow. So water moves under the force of gravity towards the ocean. But if the ocean is higher than the elevation of those storm drains, then it'll reverse flow back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's the flooding that you're seeing there. And during the King Tides, we were seeing that a little bit in Waikiki.
And so that was during the King Tide that was happening back in May. I mean, was the situation extreme in Mapunapuna as a result?
It was. Yeah, it was pretty extreme.
So what would you expect for this this new King Tide coming up in, I guess, the 23rd, 24th of June?
Right.
Do you expect it to be higher than what it was back in May or about the same?
We'll have a better sense, recognizing that wave forecasts are usually on like a 7. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll have a better sense early next week.
In terms of the south swell.
In terms of a south swell, particularly here in Honolulu. We have started to see that ocean bulge and some of those eddies have either moved on or slightly dissipating.
Mm-hmm.
But the tide prediction itself is higher for this month than it was last month. So it's not with any certainty that we can say it'll be as visually captivating. as perhaps it was in May. But the important thing to remember is that it's all scientific collection. So we're not out there looking for sensational events. We're out there looking for the data, mm-hmm. which we then can use to talk about the trends or talk about the impacts after the fact. So,
well, you know, with this coverage in general about climate science and public policy, certainly the visuals were impossible to not connect to those things. I was at the Arizona Memorial. I had never seen the water that high under the memorial before. Mm. Pictures from Coconut Island and Hilo. It is, you know, kind of hard to not think about that. I noticed that you mentioned the overall trend of climate change being one of the different ingredients that constituted that large king tide in May. But do you have is there a good body of science or data for Hawaii in particular focused specifically on the impact of overall global climate change?
Yes, but a lot of that also has to be downscaled. And those global models, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they will be forthcoming with their newest edition in a year or so or plus. We have something called the National Climate Assessment where the fourth edition is coming out, and there's an Islands and Pacific Islands chapter in that. So again, we're users of a lot of this information and helping to translate it and communicate it and really doing this kind of citizen science, that first-person, place-based experience and those observations, as you alluded to. It's alarming, even for us who had been out there doing some of these documentations last year. And with the expectation that it would be wet and flooded, we were like eyes open in a lot of these places because of all these other things that can impact the water levels along the coast.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking to Matt Gonzer from the Sea Grant program and Shelley Hable, and she's a PhD candidate looking at sort of the effect of our groundwater with these rising sea levels. And we're talking about king tides. And, you know, one of the things that I think you just mentioned, Matt, is the idea of citizen participation. Now, in the last, you know, when we had a lot of news coverage, I was pleased that there was so much coverage. But was the citizen science piece part of that coverage?
Yeah, so we were thrilled that these news media mm-hmm. were actually using the photographs from the public data set. They asked us, how do we access the photos? They asked us, how do we appropriately cite it? So thank you for appropriately citing the photos. And they're really helping us get the information out, and it was just great.
So maybe, Shelley, tell us a little bit about the citizen science piece and how can, you know, people actually participate and be a part of collecting data on these king tides?
I think that would be a better question for Matt, actually.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Primarily, PacificIslandsKingTides.org is really the best location to get all this information. But the short answer is we're primarily using a free smartphone application.
Mm-hmm.
It auto-populates a fair amount of the important information, the time, the date, the location. We ask you to take a photograph. We ask you to write a couple of comments about it. And then it's immediately uploaded to this free, publicly available data set. And that's where we then try to take the information and actually plot it on a map.
Mm. So, Shelley, for your field of study, we talk about groundwater. I think when we're seeing these news stories, we imagine we're talking about maybe damage to property. We're talking about losing beaches and valuable resources for our visitor industry. Is your study or your area of study more focused on things like, for example, freshwater inundation or brackish water or changing environmental conditions along our shoreline? What's the hazard of king tides from your perspective?
Well, for my study area, which is Waikiki, a lot of the groundwater is brackish. We don't use it as a drinking source. So if it gets saltier, that doesn't mean anything for groundwater drinking resources.
Mm-hmm.
It only really means corrosion for underground assets.
Hmm.
So the king tide with respect to my study, it's more about flooding of basements.
Oh.
Yeah. So we're seeing flooding in basements all the way back to Baritania.
That's pretty far inland.
Yeah. I was surprised to see that because so you don't see a lot of groundwater inundation at the surface quite yet. It's still below the ground, but you're starting to see it affect those underground assets. And that validates that groundwater is being lifted by sea level. And as it keeps on rising, that groundwater is going to start like breaching the ground surface.
Now, this is interesting because I'm not used to the idea of basements in Hawaii, but evidently there are basements in Hawaii,
yeah.
And they, you know, and you can't go too far down because, like you said, I mean, you know, it's sea level already.
Yeah.
Are the people that have basements, are they starting to express concern? And how does your study help them to, you know, I guess, mitigate this situation?
Well, I think they are very concerned about flooding in their basements, especially when it's chronic. So it started out as kind of an episodic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's become, you know, it'll be flooded in the basement for a month. And in places that use basements as like offices or, you know, workplaces, managers are worried about people slipping and falling or mold growth and people having reactions to the mold. So it's having consequences that we hadn't even really thought of.
And certainly, infrastructure, people like to put their data centers in basements. There's pipes that they might not have painted with, and you know, waterproofing or rust-proofing that suddenly becomes vulnerable to salt water. I can certainly see that.
Or your data-related radio shows.
Yeah, we are in a basement now, actually.
Yeah. I think this is hopefully far up
still
enough.
Dry. It's still dry.
The ground's still dry here. So in terms of the the app that is being used, it's called Liquid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to we'll put the link up, but from the Sea Grant page, you can actually go to the Liquid page and sign up for an account. I'm curious. So that particular app is also downloadable for your smartphone, right? But you have to actually set up an account first on the web before you can use the smartphone. Because I tried, what held me up was I couldn't actually get signed up on the smartphone. I had to do it from the desktop.
Yeah, you got it. You nailed one of the main criticisms, which is it's kind of a two-step process.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, we're using all sorts of free things, right? We're not the developers
app,
so we can't always field some of those troubleshooting problems. But these folks, Liquid, they've been phenomenal in working with us. And the reason we're able to use it for free is because we've made the data set publicly available.
Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about that. Do you know how many users or how many submissions? Can you give us an idea of so far the scale of the citizen participation?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, in total, we have over 1,300 photographs and just shy of 1,200 records. So you can actually submit more photographs. You can submit multiple photographs per record, data record. But in May alone, we had over 800 photographs. So this was our third photo survey. The vast majority of the participation was last month, and almost two-thirds of those who registered in the month of May.
That's 2017. Pretty impressive.
Wow. So we really are stoked with the great participation. We're thrilled by the coverage because we can go do trainings, we can do presentations, but the media really helped us get the message out.
You have human sensors all across the state now.
Yeah, and that's the point of it, citizen science, collecting information anywhere, everywhere, all the time.
So I took a picture at the visitor center at Arizona where the water was above the actual edge of the visitor center. So basically it was on the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Harbor was on the lawn. Let's say I send that picture in. What does a scientist do with that? Who evaluates it and what does that mean?
Well, if we have a simulation of future flooding and that simulation shows that there's going to be flooding in that area, that's a good sign that our model is working well.
It's not a good sign in general.
Right.
But it's the utility of the photos, just as Shelley was alluding to, is they can search by area, they can search by date. That allows them to look at what was the recorded tide at that day and time, compare it against whatever inundation level they had been modeling, and allows the refinement and ultimately informed decision making. Right. So I'll not to cut you off, but we have four main objectives of the project. One, just to educate and train citizen scientists on coastal hazards, including sea level rise. Two, actually do the photo surveys and the observations, so getting out there for that first person experience. Three, really using that experience as the launching pad or the catalyst for these discussions about what to do now that we see it. Okay, so now what? And then fourth, to really use that citizen science generated data for research and applying it for decision making.
Now, in terms of the actual process of adding your record into the system, you go out there, you take a picture. Does the app actually pull the lat and long information from the photo? So you have to make sure that, you know, geolocation is on
Yeah.
So you don't have to know exactly where you are from a lat long standpoint.
No, you have to give it permission to use yours, but you tap, in essence, what looks like the location services button in the data record, and it populates your latitude and longitude for you. Mm-hmm.
So then you can, as a researcher, just pull up all the photos from this particular lat long location and then see what the variety of different sort of examples of how a king tide might affect that area. Mm-hmm.
So we actually, and we won't do it until the end of this summer's photo survey. We'll take all the data that was collected for May, June, July, and then we will then plot it on a map so that it's even easier for people to, if they just wanted to surf an online web portal and look for a location, click those points, and then the photographs and all the data pops up.
Now, Shelley, is this data set useful in your research?
Oh, it's extremely useful. Yeah, because I make maps that show future flooding. So if I can simulate like an event such as the King Tide we saw the other day, and it shows me flooding, and then I have a picture from a citizen scientist that shows that flooding is real, then it gives me confidence in my model. And as I project further, like higher sea levels, I can have confidence that the flooding that I see in the simulations is also correct.
Fantastic.
Now, Matt, you know, you have another weekend coming up that's going to be another, you know, good example of a king tide. Are you specifying where you would like people to go out and take pictures? I know the last time we had you on, there were some specific areas. So in this go-around, where would you like people to go and at what time?
Yeah, we certainly still have gaps in the coverage, but at this level, we're very much just at awareness and participation. We're just asking people to go where they're going to be on a Friday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon, wherever that might be. Perhaps it's a place they frequent, so it's somewhere they could go back and take a recurring set of photographs. So we're not so inclined to say, please go to the, you know, Waianae, please go to Kolaupoko. Like, go where your backyard is and where you're just happening to be. And those dates, again, are June 23rd and 24th next week. All the tide times and the nearest location, is all that information is at pacificislandskingtides.org.
And so would you like them to take pictures of the high tide and then maybe at some point in time, you know, take a low tide example, sort of you can see the comparison?
Yeah, so we don't want to overtax or over-ask, but if you're certainly going to be out there and you're interested in taking a low tide, high tide comparison, please submit both of that. We just ask that in the comments section you write whether it was high tide or low tide.
And Shelley, I mean, where can people go to find out more about what you're working on?
They can Google Coastal Geology Group.
Okay.
That's the group I work for, yeah.
Coastal Geology Group?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yep.
Good.
And how far along are you in your PhD program?
Funding ends in a year, so I'm done in a year.
And Matt, I mean, in terms of the, you know, this King Tide citizen science piece, I mean, how long will you want to keep this effort going?
Ongoing. I mean, this is an important project. We can just continue to collect the information, as Shelley alluded to. It's really helpful.
Very good.
Fantastic.
Well, Matt Gonser is with the Sea Grant Program, and Shelley Habel is a PhD candidate over in the Department of Geology and Geophysics. We want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll talk to the winners of the Alawai Challenge.
And if you missed any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And, of course, you can also find it on the new mobile app. Just go to HPR, iTunes,
in your app store,
download it. And of course, if you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm @BiteMarks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And of course, we'll see you here next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.